Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. Our guest this hour writes in a recent piece in The Conversation that Bernie Sanders is not going to be the Democratic presidential nominee unless the Justice Department indicts Hillary Clinton over the State Department email scandal, which seems highly unlikely. She is going to be the Democratic nominee for president. Nevertheless, he has made a huge impact on the race. His campaign has fundamentally changed the Democratic Party by moving it to the left. Sanders' success, he writes, in the 2016 campaign is so noteworthy, he embraces the word liberal more proudly and enthusiastically than any Democrat since Walter Mondale in 1984. And he has really done remarkably well. The Atlantic had an interesting piece this morning, writing that Sanders has won about 6.65 million votes across 21 primaries, some 41% of all ballots cast. It means that he has captured a greater percentage of the total primary vote than previous insurgents, Howard Dean in 2004, 6%, George McGovern, 25% in 1972, Jesse Jackson in 88, 29%, Gary Hart in 84, 36%, and Ted Kennedy in 1980. So that's a pretty remarkable feat. We're going to be talking about Bernie Sanders, his incredible number of people who are under the age of 30 who have embraced him. He has won the youth vote significantly here in the state of Wisconsin, just adding to the list of the states where he has won by huge margins. In Iowa, young voters, 70% margin, 70-point margin. New Hampshire, 83%, 81%. Michigan, Wisconsin, 81%. And you got to admit, it's kind of amazing. He's a 74-year-old Democratic socialist from Vermont. Our guest writes with a cranky disposition and a strong Brooklyn accent. And look at what he's doing. So we're going to be talking about Bernie this hour of the program. And our guest is Professor Anthony Goggin. He's an associate professor of law at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. He has Wisconsin ties, got his PhD in history from UW-Madison. He's the author of The Last Battle of the Civil War, United States versus Lee, 1861 to 1883. He is also a former U.S. Navy officer and an Iraq War veteran, served as a staff officer for a U.S. military joint task force in Baghdad from August of 2008 till July of 2009. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We're fresh off a primary here, and we talked a little bit about how well Bernie Sanders did in the state of Wisconsin, but today we look at this larger picture and welcome your calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's at K. Dunn Show. Professor Anthony Goggin, thank you very much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's my pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. You write in your piece that millennials are the driving force behind the liberal renaissance. Why is this generation so liberal, and what has made them turn out for Bernie in such huge numbers?
Kathleen, I think there's a couple reasons for it. First, the Pew Center has been tracking the ideological inclinations of the different generations for several decades now. And one of the things they've found is that this generation of young people, millennials, are facing a much tougher economy than previous generations.
Yes.
If you look at wealth accumulation for people in their 20s, early 30s, it's much less than previous generations. And so the idea that the government has a role to play in the economy is finding a lot more traction with young people today than would have been the case during the Reagan era in the 1980s or the Clinton era in the 1990s. And then you combine that with the fact that we're seeing very sweeping social change in the United States in a variety of ways, and the millennials, by any measure, are far and away the most receptive to the idea that same-sex marriage is a good idea and that social change is necessary in the country. So I think there's really a combination of forces that have led to this generation of young people being more liberal and more progressive than we've seen over the course of the last 30 or 40 years.
So would it be safe to say then by 2020, perhaps, you will no longer see a Democratic moderate or a member of a Democratic establishment, unless he or she were pretty liberal, who would be the candidate for president?
I do think it will be harder for a moderate candidate to be nominated in the 2020s by the Democratic Party, simply for this reason. Right now, about 40% of all Democrats self-identify as liberal, but the millennial generation as a whole self-identifies as liberal by about 40%. And then if you just concentrate on millennials who are Democrats, the great majority of Democratic millennials self-identify as liberal. So that means inevitably with the passages of time, we will see that a majority of Democrats self-identify as liberal. So yes, I think the future, as far as national elections go, the future will be with liberal Democratic candidates for president, not with moderate candidates in the Bill Clinton mold.
Let's talk about what Bernie has done, his influence in this race. You ask us in your piece to look at Clinton's campaign. She planned to use the same centrist playbook as her husband did in the 90s, and it's why she thought she could get away with giving paid speeches to Wall Street firms. She did not fear a liberal challenge.
That's right. I think she was confident coming into the 2016 election that she would be able to pivot to the general election very quickly, particularly once it was clear that Elizabeth Warren was not going to get into the race. And she announced she's a senator from Massachusetts. I think the Clinton campaign viewed Elizabeth Warren as far and away the most formidable potential challenger. And when it turned out that the only serious challenge Clinton would face would be from Bernie Sanders, a independent socialist from Vermont, the Clinton campaign did not view him as a real threat. And so I think no one's been more surprised in the Clinton campaign that Bernie Sanders has been able to connect in a very deep and profound way with the liberal base of the Democratic Party.
So how has she changed her positions as a result of his victories?
Well, it's really striking to compare where she is today from where she was even 8 years ago when she ran in 2008 for president, and certainly to compare where she is today with where her husband was in the 1990s. Just by way of comparison, in the 1990s, Bill Clinton ran as a tough-on-crime Democrat who advocated 100,000 new police and tough sentences for people convicted of felonies, whereas Hillary Clinton is now campaigning on the idea that the United States has locked up too many people. We have millions of people behind bars in the United States. A huge percentage of the incarcerated population is made up of nonviolent offenders. And so she is now adopting the same kind of rhetoric that Bernie Sanders has, which is that we need to emphasize non-prison alternatives for nonviolent offenders. We need to end the policy of mass incarceration. That would have been unimaginable for Bill Clinton, a position for Bill Clinton to adopt in the 1990s. So clearly, the center of gravity within the Democratic Party on issues like law and order has moved since the mid-90s. And I might add, it is moving among Republicans as well.
Yes.
Rand Paul, a libertarian candidate, has also been a critic of mass incarceration. So we are seeing on certain issues a general move towards the left. But within the Democratic Party, it's most obvious and most pronounced.
Mm-hmm. Particularly on issues like economic inequality, even some of the top Republican candidates have been discussing that, right?
That's right. Although, substantively, I'd say of the three candidates who are left, Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and John Kasich, their economic proposals really are not fundamentally different than Ronald Reagan's as far as issues of tax policy. Trump's are definitely out of the Republican mainstream on issues of trade. Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are both advocates of trade protectionism. So that definitely makes Trump different than the traditional Republican. But where I think we see the biggest difference between the two parties on economic issues, it's the fact that the Democratic Party is now more willing to talk openly about raising taxes. That's something that we really haven't seen as a part of Democratic presidential politics since Walter Mondale in 1984 famously said that he would raise your taxes, and he lost 49 states in 1984, and that really made a deep impact on the Democratic Party and national politics. And so the idea that you can now run safely as a Democrat by advocating tax hikes, that represents
it's
a real
pretty amazing.
It is.
Mm-hmm. You referred us, and I'm glad you did, to a recent piece in The New Yorker that gives us some historical perspective here, which I found interesting. Money in politics, particularly since Citizens United, nobody has made this argument as powerfully as Bernie Sanders day after day. This author writes, he's spoken in terms that haven't been heard from a serious major party candidate since William Jennings Bryan, the great prairie populist who famously accused his opponent William McKinley and the money and interests who supported McKinley of trying to crucify upon a cross of gold. Republicans of Bryan's day called him a fanatic. He never became president, but he helped to create this progressive movement in the country.
Yes, and there was also one major difference in the early 1900s from today, and that was the fact that you had a lot of progressives in the Republican Party, like Bob La Follette from Wisconsin, and you also had a lot of conservatives in the Democratic Party. In fact, the Democratic president at the time that Bryan ran for president in 1896 was a man named Grover Cleveland, and he was, even by the standards of the day, a conservative Democrat. And so what's changed in the late 20th century and early 21st century is that we've had ideological realignment of the two parties, where virtually everyone who self-identifies as liberal is a Democrat, and virtually everyone who self-identifies as a conservative is a Republican. And so polarization is really the driving force in politics today in a way that it really wasn't 50 or 100 years ago.
So if Hillary Clinton is nominated, and it would appear at this point in time that she will be, what does she do with all of these issues that she's moved to the left on? Does she have to be a president who governs more liberally, or do all of these ideas go by the wayside? How do people, particularly in the millennial generation, hold her to governing the way she's campaigned?
Well, I think it's all going to depend on what happens in the congressional races. So right now, the Republicans control the House and the Senate, but there is a very real chance that the Democrats will take control of the Senate, and certainly if a Democrat wins in the presidential election, it's likely they'll have coattails sufficient to give the Democrats a majority in the Senate. That then means what Hillary Clinton would be able to achieve legislatively is going to come down to whether or not she can pick off enough moderately conservative House Republicans to actually get legislation through the Congress. And so her fate, if she's elected president, is still tied to whether or not she can find enough Republicans willing to engage in bipartisan legislation to actually get things done. Obviously, President Obama was not successful at persuading the Republicans to essentially work with him in getting centrist legislation through the Congress. Whether Hillary Clinton will be able to is something that that is certainly yet to be determined.
Mm-hmm. And you're a professor at Drake University. We've heard some talk about millennials who are so enthusiastically supporting Bernie Sanders not voting for Hillary Clinton. Do you think when it comes right down to it, they will carry through with that, I'm going to sit home, or are they going to vote?
No, I think they probably will vote for this reason. In 2008, almost at the exact same point in the campaign as we are right now, there is a lot of talk that disgruntled Hillary Clinton supporters might not vote for Barack Obama in the fall election. Well, that fear did not materialize. Democrats did unify behind Barack Obama. I suspect because the stakes are so high and because there's so much fear and even loathing of Donald Trump and Ted Cruz among Democrats, that we are going to see high turnout on the Democratic side in November, including among millennials.
We welcome phone calls. All of our lines are jammed right now, so there's a lot of interest in this topic, and I'm glad you wrote about it. Our guest this hour is Professor Anthony Goggin. He's a professor, associate professor of law at Drake University. Wrote a piece about how Bernie Sanders is making the Democratic Party safe for liberals. Here's our phone number. Keep it in mind, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We are on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow, and we'll be with you in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's talk about Bernie Sanders and what he's been doing for the Democratic Party, moving it more to the left, and why millennials particularly are embracing him so wholeheartedly. John in Elkhorn is our first caller. Hi, John.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I've been waiting for a point to call in over the political season and address, I don't want to call it my fears. I would say that I'm a good Bernie Sanders supporter. The problem that I have is this: when you go back when he announced his candidacy, he kind of said that he would need some type of revolution to see himself be elected. You know, the problem that I have is that your guest brought it up, is that I just don't see how Bernie could ever legislate some of the things that liberals like myself, things like single payer, could ever happen in a congressional Congress that we have today. I think that the biggest issue that peeves me off is these off-year elections where people like Ron Johnson get elected over a guy like Russ Feingold. And I'm a strong Obama supporter just because I know what he's gone through to try to get anything done. And I just, even if we took back the Senate, I just don't see, even some Democrats would run to the middle and would not be willing to embrace anything on the liberal side.
Hmm. All right, John, thanks for the call. What do you think, Professor?
Oh, I think John makes an excellent point that Bernie Sanders would obviously, if he were elected president, would not be able to implement his agenda without a Congress that's willing to go along with it. And the caller makes another really important point, which is even if the Democrats were to take the House back, and there are some statistical models that suggest if Donald Trump were the Republican nominee, he's so wildly unpopular with about 70% of the country saying they won't vote for him, there is a chance Democrats could win the House of Representatives. And Ted Cruz is a pretty controversial and unpopular candidate as well. So if he gets the nomination, I think there is a chance the Democrats could take not just the Senate, but the House back.
Do you really? Wow.
I think that is possible. But here's the catch. If Democrats do take the House back or the Senate back, most of the pickups will be made in swing districts, which means the Democratic candidates who will have won will be moderates. Mm-hmm. And so just as John suggested, even if you do have Democratic House, whoever the president is going to need to accommodate the interests of moderate Democrats as well as of liberal Democrats. So I would not anticipate, let's say the Democrats sweep everything in November, I don't think we're likely to see a single-payer health care plan being on the agenda in 2017, especially after the brutal battle that the Obama White House went through in 2009. I would expect that the three areas where a future progressive presidency would focus on would be education, the environment, and transportation. And probably, I think, transportation would be the very first item on the agenda of a Clinton administration because the nation's transportation infrastructure is in such a state of disrepair. And there is actually pretty broad consensus that we, within the business community, that we need to engage in very substantial infrastructure spending at the federal level for the good of the economy long term.
John, thanks for the call. Mike in Milwaukee, hi.
Well, Kathleen, first off, I'm going to correct your pronunciation of the word huge. It's huge.
Okay, Mike.
With a Y. I just want to address that last caller, and then I have a point. I'll do it real quick. Eisenhower wanted to get an interstate highway system done, and the Congress was against that. Sputnik went up, and he said, you know, we need to get evacuate people if there's nuclear weapons launched from the Soviet Union. Boom, we had an interstate highway system. Kennedy said, we're going to land a man on the moon. Who believed him? He was a dreamer. And we have two presidents here that got done what their dreams were. We need dreamers. Thomas Edison took, 1,200 times to get the right filament in the light bulb before he got it. I'm sure people thought he was crazy and a dreamer. We need people like Bernie to start the fire. And with, as with the millennials, you're going to get people to say, you know what, maybe this guy can get it done. And he will get the people behind him. So the other thing I wanted to say is, you know, in the beginning of the debates and so on and so forth, Hillary was way on the right of, she was a moderate or maybe a moderate Republican, I don't know. But what happened was, as we progressed into the primaries, she slowly changed. And one of the last debates I saw Hillary, every time Bernie said, we need to get the money out of Washington, she says, me too. Her rebuttal was always, I want to get the money out of Washington. I want to make free education. I want to address education, too. And, you know, it was just just like Saturday Night Live, they showed the woman as Hillary, and then by the end she had her hair messed up, she had a suit coat on, and she was Bernie Sanders. My question is, if she was so willing to change and flip-flop all the way over to become a mini-me Bernie Sanders, what is she going to do when she's running against Ted Cruz?
All right, let's get a response. Professor Goggin.
Right. I mean, those are all great points, but I would point out that even the examples that the caller cited are examples actually of fairly traditional moderate politicians who respond to political changes that are underway in the country, like Dwight Eisenhower. He was certainly no radical. Eisenhower was a moderate Republican who was able to cut deals with the Democratic-controlled Congress in order to get the National Highway Act passed. Same thing in the 1960s. You know, John Kennedy was absolutely running as the candidate of idealism in 1960, but after his assassination is when most of the most important legislation in the 1960s was passed, and that was all done by Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was absolutely the archetypal example of the Democratic establishment. He'd been in Congress since the 30s. He was a wheeler and dealer. He is viewed as a very dishonest and untrustworthy person, but he was somebody who was also extremely skilled at getting things done in Washington. And in fact, most of the modern era of liberal legislation was passed by LBJ. And the other example would be Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was also a man known to be very devious, very unpredictable. And yet, as president, he ended up putting through Congress the New Deal legislation that really created the modern government structure that we have today in terms of the social safety net, Social Security, and a whole variety of other things. So if you actually look at the record of the last 100 years, it usually ends up being candidates like Sanders who spark the conversation, just like William Jennings Bryan did in the 1890s, but it ends up being more of the traditional politicians who actually get the legislation passed.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Joanne in Jacksonport, hi.
Hi, and thank you so much for this program. And I would like to mention that I'm 84, so I fall in, and I know a lot of people old like me. I think Bernie Sanders has just lit a fire under people. And thinking back to what this gentleman just said about FDR, we have a lot of programs that still are visible besides the social ones. We have forests, we have certain bridges, we have certain parks. And I think it brings to mind, what do we expect the government to do, and what should it do for people that are just nowhere? And I think that some of his ideas, for one thing, global warming, who's talking about global warming? And we just can't sit with our heads under rocks. And also the infrastructure, including the electrical grid. Everybody knows that that could be hacked, not too difficult a way, and where would we be then? And Bernie is more up to speed on this sort of thing. And two, he's lit a fire and other people are going to respond. But I think with people like Elizabeth Warren and others in the Senate and his years in the Senate, we might be surprised. And I think even if he doesn't win, I hope to goodness Hillary stays more to the left, because even though I consider myself a progressive, I think Bill Clinton was the best Republican the Democrats ever elected.
Thank you, Joanne. You're sounding good and strong at the age of 84. Thank you very much for the call. Professor Goggin.
Yes, I think Joanne is definitely right that if you look at examples of positions that Sanders has taken, they really are ahead of the curve in terms of where we actually are now. In the 2016 election itself, Sanders has been talking about these issues for years, like income inequality. And in fact, it's kind of interesting. Vice President Joe Biden pointed out last fall that Hillary Clinton wasn't talking about income inequality until Bernie Sanders made it an issue. On the other hand, there are some aspects of Sanders' campaign that have been criticized on the grounds that his position on issues like trade, for example, would actually make it pretty difficult to get sweeping environmental treaties enacted. Paul Krugman of the New York Times wrote a column a few weeks ago in which he noted that if you're actually going to fight climate change, you have to do it at the international level, which means you need to get other countries to agree to binding treaties to reduce carbon emissions and fossil fuel use. But if at the same time you're abrogating international treaties you've entered into on trade policy, which is so important. You know, free trade is hugely popular in countries like India and China because they're export countries, but they're also countries that are leading the carbon emissions problem because, of course, they're in the process of industrializing. We would be highly unlikely to be able to get them to agree to restrict carbon emissions in an environmental context if at the same time we're telling them we're no longer going to honor these international free trade agreements we've entered into in the past. So that's an example, I think, of why a lot of congressional Democrats don't actually support Sanders. The superdelegates, who are mostly Democratic office holders, they overwhelmingly support Hillary Clinton rather than Bernie Sanders. And this whole issue of trade and the environment is one example of why Sanders is viewed as impractical in terms of what the implications of his policies would be, while at the same time he's very broadly respected because he's willing to talk about these issues in a way that Democrats in the past have been afraid.
Thank you so much for your call, Joanne. Good to hear from you. I want to talk just a little bit about the press and Bernie Sanders, and I don't want to embrace a conspiracy theory here, but it does seem to me, and I know it does to you as well, because you wrote this piece that looked at how important his whole campaign has been, that this story has not been reported very widely. In fact, I was looking at, and they had to correct themselves, the New York Times today. They were writing about Tuesday's Wisconsin primary and said Senator Ted Cruz, soundly, this is their report that came out at 10:54 Tuesday night, Senator Ted Cruz soundly defeated Donald Trump in the Wisconsin primary, breathing new life into efforts to halt Mr. Trump. On the Democratic side, the New York Times writes, Senator Bernie Sanders defeated Hillary Clinton in a much closer contest, which was not true at all. Sanders beat Clinton by more than Cruz beat Trump. It's a story that just doesn't, it's a big thing that's happening, it seems to me, no matter where you are politically. But for some reason, nobody seems to want to examine what Sanders is doing. I don't fully understand that. Do you?
Right, Kathleen. In fact, I write a weekly column for theconversation.com, and in my column this week, I make the point that Sanders actually has a chance to win the nomination if he can get the superdelegates to switch sides. And because basically what the problem that he's facing is the Democrats have a proportional delegate award system. And what that means is in a case like Wisconsin, where Sanders wins a big victory, he won by about 15 percentage points, and that is absolutely a blowout.
It was big, yeah.
Yet he only netted about 10 delegates from it because Hillary Clinton ends up getting about 43% of the delegates, and Sanders gets about 57% of the delegates. Well, since Clinton came in with her big early victories like Florida and South Carolina, she's got such a big lead that in terms of pledged delegates, which means the delegates that are awarded to the winner of each primary caucus, it's almost impossible for Sanders to catch Clinton because even when she loses these primaries, she's still getting about 40 to 45% of the delegates. And therefore, the superdelegates, who are much maligned because the Sanders people look, or Sanders supporters look at the superdelegates as an example of the establishment stealing the election from them, the superdelegates are actually crucial to Sanders because the superdelegates are free to change their mind. Right now, they're supporting Clinton. But if Sanders were to win in New York, and if he were to win in California in June, there is a real chance that you could see significant defections from the superdelegates from Hillary Clinton to Bernie Sanders. And indeed, that's exactly what happened in 2008 when the superdelegates were aligned with Clinton, defected and went to Obama. So there is a chance that Sanders could pull this off. It's very difficult, but it comes down to whether or not he can win over the superdelegate. Mm.
And we're welcoming phone calls. Our guest this hour here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio is Professor Anthony Goggin, Associate Professor of Law at Drake University. We're talking about Bernie Sanders and why his success in the 2016 campaign, even if he is not the party's nominee, is so noteworthy. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter. Benjamin sent this email, Professor Goggins, saying, being a Gen Xer, I am sick of hearing so much about how important the millennials are. They are pie in the sky, entitled daydreamers. They're not old enough to remember the past 8 years of this current administration. If President Obama couldn't get a option included in the ACA for something akin to a single payer, how do they expect a self-described socialist to get anything done?
Well, I should say, in full disclosure, I'm actually a Generation Xer as well. But as somebody who teaches millennials, I really do not think that the millennials have a sense of entitlement. They are idealistic, and sometimes they may be overly idealistic about what is achievable, but they are not they don't have a sense of entitlement for the very reason, as pointed out in that Pew Research study, they're facing a tougher economy than previous generations have faced. They also have the overhang of student loan debt. So I think in a lot of ways, the millennials actually have a more a tougher road to hoe in terms of the future that they're facing, unless there are obviously some pretty big changes made in the country's policies. But I think ultimately the task for a future Democratic president will be to explain to the Democratic base why the policies that the president is pursuing are the most effective and achievable policies. In some ways, I think Barack Obama didn't do as good a job as he could have of communicating to Democratic voters why the Affordable Care Act was the best route to take rather than going with a single-payer mm-hmm. plan. I think communication is absolutely critical for the success of any president when it comes to actually maintaining their base. And in a lot of ways, if you look at Barack Obama's presidency, on balance, I think from an objective point of view, it has been a successful presidency. But in some ways, he's viewed as a disappointment by a lot of people on the left because they think he should have done more. But politics, in the end, does become the politics of what's achievable are what really matter. The candidates like Sanders are critically important for setting a high bar, but ultimately, you do need pragmatists in there in the trenches in Congress actually achieving what people would like, or ultimately enacting legislation that is the most that's achievable for any particular president to attain.
Claire in Madison. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen and Professor. What I was going to say ties in beautifully with that email or Facebook comment you just read, Kathleen. This is the problem with the country right now, in my opinion. We have a two-party system that is clearly, clearly crumbling, in my opinion. People are voting for Bernie, not necessarily because he's a Democrat, but because they believe in what he wants to accomplish. And President Obama, who was elected twice, had a lot of things that he wanted to accomplish that have been totally obstructed by the other party. I think our two-party system is failing Americans in general. And, you know, look at the Republicans, 17 candidates for president, and they're down to Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, who are both relatively unpopular. I think we need to explore maybe ways to make our political system more effective to represent everybody in the country.
Professor Goggin.
Claire makes a good point. I would say the reality is our parties reflect where the country is, and the country has been deeply divided since the 1990s. Surveys show that we are seeing, with every election cycle, more polarization. In other words, liberals are becoming more liberal, conservatives are becoming more conservative. But I also think Claire is right that this two-party system that has been in place in America since the 1850s is under intense strain right now. It's most obvious in the Republican Party, mm-hmm. where we're seeing leading Republicans openly speculate about whether or not the party will survive the 2016 election. So I would predict that as we move into the 2020s, we're going to see significant levels of political volatility, and it's possible we'll see the rise of a third party.
Mm. Well, and it is true that people are really not having a very easy time of it, and they haven't been for quite some time. The statistics show that the economy is picking up a little bit, but you look at millennials and the prospects they face for jobs when they get out of school and trying to patch together two or three different jobs and delay having a family and delay getting married and all of those things that people usually do in their 20s. People have to hold off on, and that a lot of people have seen their paychecks just not keeping up with inflation. They're stuck. They've been stuck for a long, long time. And government, supposedly there to help us in some ways, has not been addressing some of this pain, and it's real.
Yeah, Kathleen, I think that's right. I think if you look at the numbers, we often use the expression 1%, sort of the 1% of the super rich against the 99% of the rest of the country. But if you look closely at the numbers, it's more like a 30-70 country. The top 30% of the population in terms of income have been doing well in general over the last 25, 30 years. But the other 70% of the country have not been. Mm-hmm. And for the typical middle-income American, they have seen their real wages decline. And so there is a crisis in working-class America. And I think what's driving the anger in the country is the fact that most working-class Americans think that the government, political elites, and the wealthier people in general just don't care about the struggles of the working class. And unfortunately, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think that the country is divided not just along party lines, which is what we focus on so much, but that it has been divided by class lines for a long period of time, and that what really has made the last 40 years different is that the older sense of noblesse oblige that you would have seen 100 years ago, where the upper classes or upper middle classes had a sense that they owe it to the rest of the country to pay back what has been given to them, to contribute in gratitude for everything they received. We have lost some of that. There isn't the same sense of civic duty among our rich as we would have seen decades ago. You can see one good example of this is just in military service. One of the most interesting places in the country, I think, to see how the country has changed is Memorial Church in the middle of Harvard Yard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Of course, Harvard University is a famous university. Well, Memorial Church was dedicated to the Harvard students and alums who died in the two world wars. And it's amazing. There are 1,100 names of Harvard students who died in those two world wars. But then you look at the list of names of Harvard students and alums who perished in the wars since, and it's very few names. Yeah. And that really reflects how the upper classes no longer have that same sense that you have to contribute just like everybody else and have to assume risks just like everybody else. And that's something ultimately we have to recapture, because ultimately the fate of America's working class is the fate of the country as a whole.
This hour, how Bernie Sanders made the Democratic Party safe for liberals. Our guest is Professor Anthony Goggin, Associate Professor of Law at Drake University. Our phone number, thank you, Claire, for your call, 800-486-8655. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show. Feel free to send us your thoughts and messages. All right, let's go to Margie in Milwaukee. Hi, Margie.
Hi. Originally, I just wanted to say that the one caller said that he didn't see a revolution around Bernie Sanders. I think one of Bernie Sanders' point was it wasn't just a revolution to get him elected, but to implement some of these changes would take a revolution from the people to make their voices known, to enact Congress to act differently as opposed to their donor funds that direct their impression, their interest somewhere else. But then when you're talking about the differences now in polarization that's happening in America, I think a lot of that goes back to the inequality, where people are blaming either the blacks, the people that are on welfare or Title 19 or anything like that, and the immigrants, there's been this impression that we have to blame somebody for our problems.
All right. Margie, your phone is kind of crummy, so we got the gist of what you're saying. Professor Goggin.
I certainly think scapegoating is a big part of a lot of the animus that you see in the rhetoric, especially obviously coming on the Republican side with Donald Trump's campaign. And we've been down this road before. George Wallace was the segregationist governor of Alabama. And in 1968, he ended up winning about 13% of the vote in by running as a third-party candidate. So it's definitely true that we are seeing how income inequality can lead to some politicians using scapegoating techniques in order to attempt to gain benefits themselves personally from the fact that there is so much economic disparity in the United States. But I would also add that we have gone through these periods before. This isn't the first time where we've seen a really significant gap between the rich and the poor. But what's really important is, ultimately, what is the actual status of the middle class? If the rich are doing super well, but the middle class are doing well as well, then you don't see political instability. You don't see the same level of anger. But what makes this period different is not only are the rich doing extremely well, but the middle class is really hurting. And I think that has led the two parties to go in two different directions, where the Democrats are now increasingly advocating the use of higher taxes to promote government spending to expand the social safety net. And we're seeing Republicans go in the opposite direction. They're basically invoking a kind of racially based nationalism to say what we need is trade protectionism and we need to build walls and keep immigrants out. So it is almost a this whole issue of income inequality has become sort of a Rorschach test.
It really has. Yeah. And Marty makes an interesting point in terms of the way that Sanders is conducting his campaign. It's not really about the personality Bernie Sanders, because as you write, he's a Democratic socialist who's 74, who's got a Brooklyn accent and doesn't tell a lot of jokes. You know, he can be described as cranky every now and then. But what he is embracing is what people are feeling in many ways, that the whole what happened in 2008, the whole crash of the economy, the housing crisis, what you just outlined for us very, very nicely just now, is what that campaign is saying. It's sort of coming from the bottom up in a way.
Kathleen, that's exactly right. And indeed, I think that's what's so admirable about Sanders' campaign. Regardless of what you think of his ideas, he's running an ideas-based campaign.
Yes, he is. A lot of ideas.
And I think that's a source of optimism for us going forward, that voters are responding to a candidate who's not attempting to flatter them, who's not engaged in scapegoating. They're responding to a candidate who's actually putting forth new and, in some cases, revolutionary ideas.
Mm-hmm. Tim on Facebook sends this. I'm a millennial. I believe we are more liberal because we've lived through the Bush wars, the Great Recession, and obstructionism aimed at our President Obama. I attended both Hillary and Bernie rallies, and while there were many more people at the Bernie rally, the campaign did nothing to sign people up for the Democratic Party or to get them involved in the party apparatus. This is a major failure. He is supposedly bringing in all these new voters, but not making an effort to keep them in the party or get other Democrats elected.
Yes, that is the fatal flaw of the Sanders campaign from the vantage point of most Democratic office holders and superdelegates. Barney Frank, the longtime liberal Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, gave a really scathing interview a few days ago about Bernie Sanders. And what he said was essentially that he likes a lot of what Sanders says, but when Bernie was in Congress, or obviously still is a senator, Bernie Sanders was not somebody who would work with the Democrats, and Bernie Sanders was not somebody who was really interested in building a big coalition among fellow politicians. And I'd say if we look at this in historical terms, that's pretty typical of the first wave politician like William Jennings Bryan in the 1890s, or Bernie Sanders today, or Barry Goldwater on the Republican side in 1964. These candidates tend to be ideologically minded, so they're driven by ideas. And then the second wave candidate is the one who actually implements the policies by building the political coalitions, such as Woodrow Wilson. You know, William Jennings Bryan ran three times as the Democratic candidate for president, lost all three times, but then in 1912, Woodrow Wilson won as a Democrat and put through a lot of the ideas that Bryan advanced. Same thing with Goldwater. He runs in 64, gets crushed by Lyndon Johnson and Democrats, but Richard Nixon, a Republican, wins in 68, and then Ronald Reagan in 1980 ended up implementing a lot of the ideas that were first proposed by Goldwater in 64. So I think that's the idea of the Sanders campaign today, it's not so much that he'll be the person who actually implements these ideas, but he's setting the agenda for a future Democratic president.
Ron is next in La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I think the Democratic Party is divided between the Democrats who want to spell Democratic with a small d, and they're back in Sanders, and then, of course, the status quo establishment, like the superdelegates, spell it with a capital D. And I think that the New York-based news media should remember that their affiliate stations only hold a broadcast license, that the airwaves that they affiliates and that the networks broadcast on belong to the people. And like I say, they kind of gave Bernie Sanders victory in Wisconsin short shrift.
Yeah, they did.
And I think they're in with the Wall Street people in many respects, the New York-based news networks. They all seem to be part of that, if not 1%, that 10%. They really aren't talking much about these international trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They didn't mention that the senators who wanted to read the text of this proposed trade treaty had to sign a statement stating they would not divulge the context of the text, that they couldn't even divulge it, not even to their constituents. They had to sign a sworn statement before they could go into a private room and read this trade treaty. This is what I heard.
Mm, thank you so much for the call. On the other hand, to give the press some benefit of the doubt here, it is true that the Republican Party is really up for grabs. I mean, the party itself is up for grabs. Donald Trump, what the heck are you going to do with Donald Trump? And the Stop Trump movement and the probably contested convention, it is a large story.
That's exactly right, Kathleen. The Trump phenomenon has caught everybody by surprise, or at least most of us by surprise, and so that really has sucked some of the oxygen out of the press coverage. But on the other hand, as the caller says, I really do think part of Sanders' appeal is the fact that he doesn't have Wall Street ties. And I think voters are really attracted to the idea that Sanders does not have a super PAC backing him. He does not ask for money for his campaign from wealthy campaign contributors, and that Sanders has really, it's a remarkable story. He's got $45 million in fundraising.
It is amazing.
March alone, all based on small contributions in the neighborhood of $30 or $40, and that is really resonating with Democratic voters.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ron, for the call. Cass in Two Harbors. Hi.
Hello. I just wanted to say I think Bernie is a very good salesman who is selling people things that they want to hear, but he's very poor at math. I believe that if the math is done on the single-payer health care system, which is just another word for the government paying everybody's health care, and you do the second program would be the free college, which I did Google on. I did Google the number of total college students in America and then the number of students at state-run universities, which is what he was planning on paying for. 15.1 million students in the public colleges, and if he's going to cover, I don't know if he's going to cover all the tuition, books, etc., but it comes out to $800 billion a year for these public college students. I don't know what it would be for the health care if you're going to cover everybody in the United States with free government health care. I don't think he has the money or could raise the money in a practical way to pay for these programs. And I know he says he's going to tax the top 1% of the rich, but I don't know how you can get that through Congress. The Republicans blocking that possibility. So,
All right. Legitimate criticism shared by many. What do you say, Professor Goggin?
I think the caller is right that free college education provided by the federal government is not going to happen. But what Sanders is responding to is the fact that the states have dramatically cut back public support for universities. Wisconsin's obviously one of the most extreme examples of this, but Louisiana and other states as well. And ultimately, I think what will be most significant about this is just that Sanders is putting this issue back on the table, and I think you will see more politicians at the state level talk about how we need K through 12 and public university education is absolutely vital to the long-term health of the economy, and therefore we need to think of education as more of an investment rather than just an expense. But ultimately, as the caller suggests, that's something that will have to be done on a state-by-state basis. It's not something that would be financially affordable at the net. national or federal level.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for being with us. We have a lot of people still on hold. I hope they'll just go to Facebook and write their comments. It was a lively and interesting hour, and we thank you for it, Professor Goggin.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Kathleen. Anytime.
All right. We'll call you again. Professor Anthony Goggin, Associate Professor of Law at Drake University in Des Moines. And he is also a former U.S. Navy officer and an Iraq War veteran. And he got his PhD at UW-Madison. So many Wisconsin ties with so many of the guests we have on. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to Kendra Smith for on-air production. If you didn't get on the air, please go to our Facebook page. We love to read all these comments in this big political season. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. News is coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and we'll continue from our studios here in downtown Milwaukee.